Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 92, it's the 12th of May. I'm Tom Francis, and with me here today are...
Marsh Davis, hello.
Hello, Todd Senior.
Hello, Graham Smith.
Hello.
Hello.
Those three people.
Saying hello a lot.
I'm sitting here with...
necessary.
I'm sitting here with an eternally frothing ale. No matter how much of it you drink, the froth just consumes the rest of the bottle and then just bubbles over the top. So it's if like, I need to stop talking to drink at any time, that's why. It's actually an emergency.
It's like the magic porridge pot, but with delicious beer.
Did anyone wish for this? It seems like something everyone would wish for.
I wish for it.
The news today, literally like an hour before we started doing this, is the announcement of Assassin's Creed Syndicate. What do we think?
With a trailer and everything. Although it's not really a trailer. And weirdly, you'd expect Ubisoft to put out some kind of extremely slickly presented cinematic. But what they've gone for is actual kind of gameplay demo. It's extremely rough and ready. I'm quite surprised that they let it go through. Not because it doesn't look fun, but because it just seems kind of antithetical to their usual policy when it comes to screenshots and any kind of media relating to their games.
There were three things that went up all at the same time on their channel. So there is like a live stream that I missed. And as soon as that finished officially, I checked their uploads and they had a trailer, I think it was called First Look Presentation or something, and then the gameplay video. And the gameplay video was like 10 minutes, the presentation was like 18 minutes, and the trailer was like 2 minutes.
Oh, in that case, I just missed the trailer somehow. Okay, well.
I didn't watch the trailer either, I just watched the gameplay video.
Yeah.
It's set in Victorian London.
Yes.
And you play as two assassins, a guy and a girl.
Are they twins?
They're brother and sister.
Right. Okay. Didn't show anything of the female assassin at all, but it was mostly Jacob. Who's the male
Jacob
assassin.
Fry.
Jacob Fry. And he's got a cane and some knuckle dusters and a hidden blade and also now for the first time a kind of hookshot device that propels you to the top of rooftops.
And the world's smallest ship's cannon on his wrist.
Yeah, a tiny little cannon on his wrist, which is adorable.
And ziplines that you can fire between buildings?
Yeah, it seemed that way. Yeah. But maybe that's just the grappling hook and it just looked like a zipline, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that seems like a strange thing to add to Assassin's Creed, a game about wall climbing.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they needed to do something to mix that up a bit. I think that adding more traversal options seems exciting to me.
Also, now horses and carriage is...
Yeah, you see a protracted sequence in which the main character kills the entire population of London in a horse and cart. Which would have probably been the greatest tragedy of maybe that decade, had it actually occurred. It goes largely unmentioned.
The most video gamey thing I've seen in quite some time is him riding his horse and carriage, which is just one horse and a carriage, into a lamppost, which knocks the lamppost over.
Yeah, cast iron lamppost.
There's quite a lot of video gamey things in there. He does,
super video gamey.
Throwing arrows from a distance or a stealth kill in front of like two other guys, and then he crouches over the corpse. There are two people just standing next to him. Well, one of whom who says, "That wasn't entirely honest."
The stealth mode is so good. Like he's walking around London in what is obviously a ludicrous outfit even for that era, but it's meant to be. You know, going incognito. He's wearing a hat and stuff like that. When he goes into stealth mode, he kind of halves his height into a kind of crab scuttle, removes his hat. He's got a hood on underneath. And somehow that goes kind of unquestioned by the local populace. Oh, he's in stealth mode now. He kind of scuttles around.
That's how convoluted the visual language of the Assassin's Creed series has become now, because if anyone remembers the first game where you had roof stealth, where, there's a big thing on social stealth in the first game. So you could join groups of monks and you'd enter stealth by entering like a prayer pose. But you could be on a rooftop and enter a prayer pose and still be technically in a kind of stealth. People just like, roof archers going, what the fuck? Hey, that's just a guy praying on a roof, man. Just let him get on with it, He's supposed to be here.
Yeah, I do feel like Assassin's Creed's mechanics have calcified now to the point where each subsequent game kind of recreates them, or kind of even in kind of enlargements and exaggerations of the mechanics, which are getting further and further away from their original ambition.
And also the fantasy of the worlds, they've become increasingly contrived, and they're evolving based on what the feature set of the last game without thinking about how that actually will look and feel in London as opposed to, a different part of the world.
It feels like sort of Theme Assassin, and it's like they made the one game and then they just kind of ported different cities and just paste like thematic elements onto top of it. But like, if you're going to make a game about an assassin in London in that period, I would start by thinking about, like, what would an assassin be doing in that period naturally. But it feels like they've just grafted on some things that were generally known to be happening in that period, like gang wars. And so now you're a gang leader and you just have to fight other gangs. And you literally just brawl with them in the streets, just headbutt them, knee them, and punch them and stuff.
And it's
the, completely out in the open.
The DLC is the Darwin and Dickens conspiracy.
That sounds awesome, though.
To be fair, that did happen. It's all true.
You have to protect Darwin from people that would kill him before his ideas will spread.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how Jack the Ripper's going to be introduced to it. He's inevitably going to be in it in some way.
He, Ezio invented the latte in Assassin's Creed 2, so hopefully we're going to invent the cup of tea here.
Yeah. I was wondering, because obviously there was kind of a slightly unjust attack upon Ubisoft for the fact that they didn't have a playable female character in their previous game. I forget even the name of it. Unity? Yeah.
Technically, there's been another Assassin's Creed game since then.
Oh, isn't it? Oh, God, I don't
know. Because Rome was, like, almost the same.
Which is, I kind of felt a bit bad for them, because although the reasons behind it were poorly expressed by the guy in the interview, it's a matter of the production cycle and the fact that they decided to have seamless multiplayer merging from single player, which had a predefined kind of character who could not easily be switched out without re-recording every single line in the game. So, obviously, at some point earlier in the process, they should have thought, maybe we should service the fact that female players are going to want to have a character they can identify with. That obviously should have been discussion. But at the point where they decided that they couldn't do it, I think that was probably a reasonable production decision. But in this game, they do have a playable female character, apparently. Although, not present in this demo, what you saw in the demo was a female character being punched repeatedly by the protagonist. Really brutally having the shit beaten out of her. So I don't know if that was kind of like a pointed thing or like, I don't know.
You do see his sister, don't you? Although you don't see her being played, you see her in the opening cutscene.
She turns up to save him in a badass way.
She's the sensible one and he's the reckless wild
young man
punching one
reckless hopefully young gentleman abroad.
There's a rumour that you only get to play as her for like 25% of the game, but I don't know if that's true at all. The smart way to do it would be to have, if they want to do co-op again, then you'd be able to play as them both simultaneously, like in story missions and stuff. And what I'm hoping for is that you would just be able to switch at any time and just play as her. That's basically, if you can play as her at any time, then I'll play it, and if you can't, I won't. That's it.
The guy wrote previously for us said that it was a kind of switch at any time deal.
Oh, well. All right, cool.
Potentially. So, I don't know. To be confirmed.
Mm. You can immediately see that a female assassin in this game, just in this series, just immediately makes loads of sense. Just looks so fucking cool. Like, way cooler than the guy.
They've done one before as well in the PSP game.
Yeah, was she like a piratey one?
Yeah. Yeah, I forget what her name was.
I think that's one of these.
There was a recent one, Assassin's Creed Chronicles China.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, the side scrolling game. That looked really good, actually. I meant to play that, but.
That's right. Yeah,
probably not.
I guess handhelds are the place you're allowed to experiment with. Maybe going as risky as someone from the other half of the human race.
I was slightly underwhelmed by London itself, actually, which is weird because the best thing about Unity was Paris. Like, an extraordinary place. Whereas London itself didn't seem like it, from the demo they showed, to be a very exciting place to navigate for an Assassin's Creed sense, the wide open streets.
We only saw a little bit of it. Yeah, I mean, we only saw some of the kind of wider, I guess,
the thoroughfare
boulevards and then some slums, which didn't look especially slummy, but, I mean, a lot of those buildings we can't really identify as London because they've all been knocked down. So it's hard to kind of gauge what the character of London would have been really without. Yeah. Mm. I'm definitely going to play it simply so I can clamber over London. That's really my main motivation.
I thought the horse and carriages looked good. It kind of had a nice atmosphere to it, just that feeling of it like a busy road with no cars.
They did say that as well as being able to drive them, you can ride on top of them and include them in your parkour moves as well, apparently. So I imagine there's going to be like hopping between carriages as they
Max
and
stuff. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You can already feel the missions being shipped, though, can't you? Just the carriage chase, just like, oh, God, I don't want to be doing that. There's going to be so many failure conditions, just every corner, every time. No, you're too far away! No, you're too close! You're too close!
Well, the demo centres around the takeover of a group of thugs, so you can kind of recruit them into your assassin army by taking them from the Templars. And at the end of the demo, you see the kind of camera pan out to the map view, and the kind of like a tiny square of London goes yellow. And you're like, oh, oh fuck, there's a whole... I'm going to have to do this like 50 fucking times.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because that's more or less what I've just added to heat signature. Okay. And I've had the same worry. It's like, in my head, I was thinking like, okay, it'll be just like the missions you're already doing, only they'll be in the context of this massive strategy map, so you'll know that it has this significance and... that there's, when you do more of them, it's not just repeating the same thing, you're making progress. Hmm. And then once I put that system in, I started, like, zoom out and thought, fuck, that thing I just did, gotta repeat that a lot of times if I want to take any kind of territory. So I've got to think about that as a design problem.
Well, how many times do you anticipate somebody doing it?
I mean, it's the missions are the whole game, that's just what you do in the game. So you will be repeating missions endlessly for all of the time that you play, no matter what I do. And so it's just a question of not making it look daunting. Like, just you don't want to see it stretching before you in a repetitive way. You want it to feel like, I want it to feel like driven by the map. So you look at something and think, I want to take out that trade route. And so what mission can I get that will do that? And then when you're doing it, you know what you're working towards.
Like, territory capture mechanics, I love the idea of them, but I'm remembering back to times when they've been tried and actually been not fun at all. Like, GTA San Andreas had a kind of gangland thing where
they took them back as well.
Yeah, just like straight away. And you had to drive back and it's just a chore. There was no sense that you're actually in a gang war at all. It was just like maintenance chores you were doing to maintain your territory. And if it's anything like that, then it's going to be grinding.
And Dawn of War, Dark Crusade, the territory map. It's a brilliant game, and the territory map is a great way of chaining together individual missions, but had the same problem of once you've taken the territory, people can take it back.
Mm.
And it wasn't so bad if it wasn't the one you just took, but if it's the one you just took, the only way to get it back is to replay the exact mission you just played again. And that was just a thing they thought was fine.
Dragon Commander as well, exactly the same problem. Like, whenever it's popped up, no one's managed to solve that. That's that loss of progression.
Maybe it's just a shit mechanic.
Maybe.
You shouldn't do it, Tom.
Well, I mean, so the map thing, the people taking back territory, I might just not do, because it is annoying. I could even make it so that you're the only person in the world who can do these missions. Like, it's just the one person. Everyone's like, I really want him on my side, because really, no one else gets anything done in this entire world.
I'm looking forward to all the local talent being hired as voice actors. Lots of kind of, God love you, governor! And stuff, lovable urchins, that kind of thing.
The Blighters.
The Blighters.
Literally called the Blighters.
Are they really? Is there a gang?
The gang is called the Blighters, yeah.
I think the leader of one of the gangs is called Bloody Nora.
Yeah, Bloody Nora is the leader of the Blighters. They just looked up English terms. First three we found.
Cheeky Nando's is, I believe, one of the gangs.
Cheeky Nando's are taking back our territory. Oh, for fuck's sake.
You can already buy, or pre-order rather, the cane sword from the game.
Oh, no.
To ready your cosplay costumes and...
Oh, in real life?
Yeah.
Right.
40 quid. Pre-order it.
I don't know, is that 36
inch long
cane blade
sword?
What? They're selling a weapon. It's a pre-order.
They don't say that it's a dull blade, but it is like a cane with a sword inside it. Like, they describe it as if this is a killing device on the thing. You can pre-order it from the Uplay website right now, $39.99.
Oh my.
All right. I thought when you mentioned that before, that you were talking about microtransactions.
No. No.
Are there going to be microtransactions in this? Do we know?
There were any.
Yeah.
There's something... £40 does sound reasonable for a coin sword. I'm not disputing that. But there's something like slightly nauseating about this kind of deciding in advance that their thing is going to be iconic. Like, this thing no one's actually seen yet. We decided this is going to be the iconic thing everyone wants or not. Yeah, and so we've already made...
Didn't work with Watch Dogs, did it? With his iconic baseball hat.
Yeah, we don't know how well that sold. Maybe the cap sold really well.
It does seem, though, that Jacob Fry's whole outfit, though, is designed to be cosplayed. Mm-hmm. Like, from the uniquely styled coat and strange leather vest thing he's wearing.
It taps into a kind of steampunk cosplay that already exists, actually.
Yeah.
I think they're trying... There's a lot of leather in their vision of London. You know, a lot of people like shiny...
But again, like it's a calcification of something which is already a caricature. Mm. You know, like they're caricaturing. They're going from the previous Assassin's Creed games rather than going from any kind of
anything that people actually wore in the title.
Yeah, I know, but that doesn't service the fantasy of being an assassin who obviously doesn't want to be peacocking about in London looking like a fucking maniac. Doing crab scuttles through the alleyways.
Where does he put the top hat when he? Like takes it off.
I don't know. Just
hold it against your chest.
We should check.
I bet it's collapsible. I bet it's like a really high tech.
Designed by plastic. Leonardo da Vinci.
It turns into a throwing disc.
Oh, I'm going to play the shit out of it. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to lie to myself.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to quite enjoy it as well.
The top hat's cool. What have you folks been playing? Anyone?
I've been playing The Witcher 3, though not on PC. On PS4. Boo this, because the PC version isn't ready for consumption yet. Hasn't been passed out to reviewers.
When's it out?
It's out next Tuesday worldwide.
It's quite late to not have any PC code, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently there's a huge day one, or they've got a day zero patch, which will fix a lot of the problems. The frame, like, PS4 version I played had pretty noticeable frame rate problems.
Huh.
So I imagine it's worse for Xbox One and PC at this stage, and they've got to get that stuff fixed before they even get it out to people. Hmm. But it's a good RPG. That's... It is a good game that's both beautiful and also just sickening and full of suffering at the same time.
Yay!
So enjoy that, everyone. I think I had to, 'cause I had to play, I reviewed it for Games Radar Plus, so I had to play it, a lot of it in a very condensed block for review. And I wouldn't recommend doing that at all, because it kind of gets to you after a while how horrible that place is, how just relentlessly gross a place it must be to exist and to live in. The first place that once the game opens out after the prologue, you go into Velen, the swamplands of Velen, and that whole place is basically, like, everything about it screams at you that humans just shouldn't live here. Everything here wants to eat you. It's just horrifying things in the bushes, in the swamps, coming out of the swamps constantly to eat peasants. And the map is vast, and you can just travel right between these towns. And everywhere you go, you trigger these side quests, that are these little contained horror short stories about how fucked these people are. They can't farm the land because there's just poisonous shit coming out of the bogs all the time. So they've made a deal with a local coven of witches, and they have to sacrifice...
Often a good sign.
Sacrifice their children to them in order to get crops. And, you know, they need a favour, they have to cut off their own ears. And when you meet the witches, they've got just, like, ears hanging in massive strings, like, round around their necks. And the whole thing is, it's genuinely horrifying in a way that I really wasn't expecting.
Huh.
It's actually really fascinating. The main plot is kind of, you know, throwaway fantasy nonsense in the end. But it's brilliant as if you play it as a kind of ronin, a guy with two swords who goes along, and if you pay him, he'll solve your problems for you. And the problems are fucking amazing and different wherever you go. The creatures they've invented, or they haven't invented them, that's the brilliant thing about them. The creatures that you meet, some of them you can talk to and they have thoughts and feelings of their own. Some of them are just, most of them are just forces of nature that happen to fuck up humans in horrible, horrible ways. Like a spirit that latches onto a person and feeds on their guilt and whispers to them whenever they sleep that, you know, about the terrible things they've done, until it drives the person to self-mutilation and eventually death. And it's just the spirit is cast to, and it's not like a punishment from God, it's just that's the nature of the thing that happens to have latched onto him, like a virus or something.
Huh.
That's how these monsters are treated. That's how Geralt sees them, because he's almost like a naturist. He just has amazing environmental knowledge of the world, and he's just really well read in this shit. And where the peasants see superstition and God and demons, Geralt just sees nature and this amoral nature that's constantly beating down, tearing at humanity wherever you go. I think the reason it's so brilliant is because they've just borrowed directly from European mythology. And they've borrowed those myths from a stage before they've hit Tolkien and Disney, and before all those monsters have been put into good or evil categories, when they just existed as things that humans didn't understand. Like, for example, the Wild Hunt itself is a big part of The Witcher 3. That's actually a really old Celtic myth, where people would see the Wild Hunt riding through the sky and that they would steal people and stuff. And it was this unknowable force. It wasn't like punishment for the gods. It wasn't put into a kind of moral framework. It was just this thing that happened that you had to deal with and fear. And that's what the monsters in The Witcher 3 are like. So a lot of them, they actually have things they want to do. Like there's a giant. And the giants, you think they're just monstrous and stupid creatures and you can't talk to them. But the frost giant has enslaved a guy on this island, feeds the guy, and he's there to build a colossal longboat because the giant wants to sail off over the ocean to fight the gods in Ragnarok. That's the thing the giant wants to do. And you never know this because you never talk to him, but there's evidence everywhere about the things these monsters and creatures want that are totally separate from humans. And it's absolutely fascinating and wonderful to discover these things as you just wander around the villages. And you like every village, there are dozens of these tiny little kind of villages. There's a notice board and you just tear off 6 or 7 quests on each notice board. And some of them are just like, you want to get into some fist fights. There's a fist fighting tournament here, or here's some horse races. And 3 of them will be like Witcher contracts. And like 1 or 2 out of those 3 will be like a properly long, twisty mystery that will lead you into like a haunted house. And maybe it won't be haunted. Maybe it'll be a kind of weird, mischievous elf that's doing this stuff, and you actually make friends with them, and then you lie to the people around them saying that house is haunted because you want that little imp to have his house and, you know, live a nice life. And the next thing you meet might be just, there's some really horrifying stuff I won't spoil, just like really properly dark fantasy stuff that it makes that world unlike any other fantasy world that I've played in a video game. And for that reason, everyone should probably play it.
This has exploded.
Can I play as the woman?
Yes, you can play as Ciri, who's the main... The plot, a huge amount of it... One of the big problems with the plot is that you spend a lot of it chasing people who are having a better adventure than you are. but at least it lets you play some of that adventure. You jump into Ciri's shoes, and Ciri's fucking awesome. She's the adopted child of Geralt, the main character, the Witch Hunter. And she's actually, turns out, the daughter... This isn't a spoiler, it's just... background knowledge. She's the daughter of the Emperor of Nilfgaard, who are invading the lands. She's also got these extraordinary abilities to teleport. She can teleport between worlds, and the Wild Hunt is after her for that ability. You spend most of the game tracking her down, and you play through some of her escapades, and she's like, her abilities actually improve the combat system, which is actually the weakest part of The Witcher 3, is combat. But she can teleport around, and that's really fun and satisfying. Later on, she gets like these teleport dash moves and stuff like that, and she's just a fucking badass character anyway. She chops up a basilisk at one point, which is great.
Awesome.
Yeah, so you can do that. Also, the other amazing thing, apart from this really rich, amazing lore, is the world itself just riding around the place. It's really, really accomplished, beautiful world design. The way that you can just race down a road at the fastest gallop that your horse can take you, and the place will seamlessly transition from really recognisable, almost like a British like countryside, into disgusting gross bogs, then to the coast, and then if you go
more
to
British countryside.
More British countryside. And then into Novigrad, which is the big capital city of the place. That's absolutely huge. And you know, I was saying that each small town has a notice board. There are like 8 or 9 notice boards just in Novigrad alone, because it's the size of like 9 or 10 of these townships glued together. And that has its own problems, like there's gang wars there, and you obviously meet all the gang leaders, and it's also got this fanatical religious organization that's burning people at the stake. The first thing you see when you go in there is people being burned alive, and one of them's a Doppler, and Dopplers are these brilliant creatures who Geralt has loads of sympathy for. Like they're just perfectly nice creatures who want to get along, and the way they do it is by assuming human form and pretending to be people. They don't have to eat the people to become them or anything, they can just make themselves look like them. And then they burn a Doppler at the stake, and you kind of transform back to his natural state, and the crowd goes mental. It's horrible. It's really horrible. Brilliant. So good. Because you're the guy who understands all this, and you can see the truth of things in the way that the peasantry can't, the people around you can't. And you're also the guy who can solve this stuff as well. But of course, the quest, a lot of the time, you know, you take action thinking you're fixing the problem, and actually things end up worse. And major characters you can just kill off if you don't handle things correctly, and that's really interesting as well. The Skelligar Isles, in particular, are one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in a game, because they're just an archipelago of kind of Nordic islands, but the art direction there is just all the lighting at every stage of the day-night cycle is perfect, which is something I love. I find the other areas less convincing because their sunset's too lurid and unbelievable, whereas in Skelligar, you get these beautiful, dull purple sunsets, and you can ride... you could get to a boat to just ride seamlessly between these islands whenever you, wherever you want. And as you ride across them, you'll see whales, you'll see, harpies flying overhead and diving for fish and stuff. And if they see you, they'll latch onto your boat and you have to shoot them with a crossbow. And sometimes you'll come across, a wreckage and you have to dive in and get some treasure from, crates at the bottom of the ocean and stuff. And I just have a really vivid memory of sailing across the sea as the sun was going down, sailing towards this misty island, and you just see, the outline and, two or three wrecked towers, wrecked castles, and I know I'm going there. I go there, I'm going to find all of those castles, and I know there's going to be interesting shit in each one of them. The feeling of going on an adventure in that moment is really precious, and I haven't had that since Skyrim.
As you were talking about this, it reminded me, it made me think of the first time I played Oblivion, and just having that kind of proper, beautiful open world where every little quest turns out to be a really interesting story.
Yeah. Yeah, they've done that. I pray that it's technically, it works. I didn't see many bugs per se, but the performance stuff is a serious issue and does actually spoil the combat, which is already pretty duff.
Is it more adept than Bethesda games in terms of the actual delivery of plot and character and voice acting and those things?
Simply in facial animation alone, the facial animation is surprisingly good. Some of the best crying. I was talking to Chris about this the other day, but the best kind of crying in the game.
Oh, that's some good crying. Perfect.
Not like cry face, like total cry face crying, but crying in a way that you don't want to be seen to be crying. And Geralt, he never actually cries because he's too, but they do
to cry.
He's the growliest protagonist, I think, since Adam Jensen. When Geralt has an emotional moment, his eyes become glassy in a really convincing way. It's really hard to do this. There's a bit where Ciri actually is crying and she's kind of pretending not to cry and she's sniffing in the motion that he cries at, and the way her nose flares and the way that her face looks is just really well animated. It really sells that emotion. And just really small things like Geralt's sarcasm, and he's quite condescending a lot of the time, and just really disbelieving looks, really subtle hard things to do that, for example, a BioWare game couldn't do. The facial animation BioWare games, they have to caricature everything to the extent that you really don't get those nuances of emotion. And there's some quite good voice acting as well, which helps.
Sounds like a step up from The Witcher 1, where the translation was just garbage most of the time.
Ah, God, The Witcher 1 has some of the worst voice acting I've still, to this day, ever heard in a video game. Yeah, they've done well.
There's a lot of stuff made about the fact that it had, 62 billion endings or something like that. Is that the kind of the branching thing, a significant thing in this game? You said you can kill major characters accidentally.
Yeah, you can. Yes. Yeah, there are things that you could do pretty serious things to the status quo. But that's really not the focus of it. They're kind of almost incidental decisions that you can pursue if you want to or not and be pleasantly surprised by when they happen. But it's not like BioWare, because one of the criticisms I'd say, one of the ways it stacks up poorly against a BioWare game is that the main quest, you're mostly passive, you're mostly following the action. Whereas in BioWare games, especially modern ones, you're always proactively impacting on the situation. You're taking control in Dragon Age and Mass Effect, you're taking control and changing the world really decisively. And that doesn't really happen in The Witcher 3. It's not really like that. And in fact, that wouldn't really suit what The Witcher 3 is about, which is you're just a little guy in a world full of little people who have it worse than you.
I heard people say the same thing about The Witcher 2, where I think the subtitle was Assassin of Kings, and a war breaks out, but you don't really actually play much of a role, because you're just like a mercenary dude that walks about the place.
It's really the same thing. It's really the same deal in The Witcher 3 as well. There's a war happening during The Witcher 3. But yeah, again, it's best enjoyed as the Ronin thing, without the expectation that you're going to be doing the BioWare thing.
I remember in The Witcher 2, there was a moment where you sort of chose who to back in some big power struggle, and that took you down a totally different path. Like, almost all the quests for that whole act were different if you chose that person. It was called Witcher 2 Assassins of Kings, plural, packing the most S's into a subtitle.
They were slightly strange names, Assassins of Kings, and then Wild Hunt, not The Wild Hunt, just Wild Hunt, which has gone wild. So I think it's Chris's joke, actually. I've just stolen it and repeated it. Sorry, Chris. You're not here. Fuck you.
I continue to credit you solely for it.
Copyright, Marsh.
Yeah, they call it The Wild Hunt in the game.
Oh, do they? Yeah, weird. Okay. And how about the ladies? Because this is has been a problem with the previous Witcher games in that they were slightly seedy.
Witcher 3 is still very titsy. There's still got that going on. I think it's a tricky one. The kind of
is it more offloaded to the kind of fiction itself? Is it kind of excusable within the fiction? Done in the best possible taste.
Some of it is. Some of it is just there are some boobs in this scene now. Which is, like, you know, stuff like Game of Thrones, so you're guilty of this as well. Hmm. And in the same way that Game of Thrones tries to have its cake and eat it in the sense that it shows a lot of tits and nudity and stuff for women, but then says, but we've got all these really strong female characters, so it's kind of, we're promoting really interesting female characters. It does have loads of really interesting female characters. All the sorceresses in the game are really formidable. Ciri's amazing. But then it also has just like hips and boobs. Yeah. It's always been a part of The Witcher, really, isn't it? It's definitely better than The Witcher 1.
There's not cards anymore.
No, oh, there are cards.
Oh, no.
Not sex cards. The good type of cards. There's actually an amazing card game built into The Witcher. It's a brilliant collectible card game which is genuinely really good. And you can...
What do you have to sleep with to get the cards?
A basilisk.
Yeah, you win cards by battling as many people as possible. And there are like rare cards to be found throughout the world. And you play kings and emperors at this card game called Gwent. It's like a three-stage facsimile of a war where you lay siege weapons and ranged cards and close combat cards onto the board and try and score as many points as you can. And it's fantastic. It's the best card game since that Final Fantasy VIII card game. I can't remember the name of it.
Put that on the box.
It's basically, it's going to take up all your time.
Yeah.
And just
and my hard drive, I imagine, as well.
Yeah, it's like 55 gigs.
Oh, Christ.
I think. And, yeah, oh God, Gwent. I almost didn't mention Gwent. Yeah, I had to stop myself from playing it because I had to finish the game. It's like, I've got to review this. I've got to get through the quest, the main line. I've got to see everything. But I just allowed myself the occasional game of Gwent because I really wanted to win cards. I was like, met this guy called Bloody Baron. I was like, I want your cards, Bloody Baron. I'll beat you down, Gwent. Bring it.
Oh man, this sounds amazing. Yeah. Is it the best game of the year so far then? I've not heard you be this enthusiastic about anything.
Actually, no, I'm actually talking about it to realise how much I love it and how much I still want to play it. Huh. Like, I've had to give the debug PS4 back, so I can't actually do it again, but I will play it again when it comes out, like when I get the PC edition. Which is, having played like 40 hours of it already, is a pretty good sign. Especially having poopsocked it over such a small... Sorry, poopsock is a phrase that we can... Is that common parlance, or is that Owen Hill special?
I think
it's common parlance.
I think there are people who don't know what it means, though.
I'm not going to explain what it means. It means to play a game a lot in long binge periods. Yeah, but yeah, I'm really excited about everyone discovering all the stuff I couldn't talk about.
What have you been playing, Marsh?
I've also got an unequivocal recommendation, which is to buy Black Mesa, which is the fan remake of Half-Life 1, which has been remade in what is apparently a hybrid version of the Source engine that was used for Half-Life 2. But it's really good. And it's good because it's not slavishly a recreation of the original by any means. It actually does a lot to kind of enlarge those environments, make them more detailed and believable. They've added loads of voice acting by the same voice actors. They've kind of I think they've re-recorded all the lines because all the dialogue sounds extremely kind of high fidelity. But also the environments themselves have just expanded. So the kind of offices that you go through at the beginning of the game, they feel like real kind of living places. And just there's been a kind of, obviously like an art pass has upgraded it to the kind of level of fidelity you'd expect kind of now. I mean, it's the Source engine, which is a few years old, so it's not, doesn't look kind of fucking mind-blowingly crisp and amazing, but it does enough to kind of update it, I think. But what's more interesting is the stuff that they've cut out, and I think they're kind of right in all the areas where they've been kind of more ruthless with the original design. They've trimmed a lot of stuff back. Do you remember the vague arc of Half-Life 1?
Yeah.
Mm. Things go wrong during an experiment. Aliens invade. You're in a secret science base, and your journey to wherever you need to go ends up taking you through like an underground tunnel network and stuff like that. And they've done a lot of stuff to trim the level design back, so there's less kind of backtracking. The environments are kind of occasionally more simple, and there's fewer platforming challenges as well. Because that was never great in the game. Mm. Although there still are quite a lot of platforming challenges in the game, and it's definitely the weakest part. There is no Zen yet. Because actually, Black Mesa was released for free. Last year, I think.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
And this version apparently is a bit more polished. There's more stuff in it. I don't know exactly how it's changed. But you spend £15 now to buy it, and you will eventually get the rest of the game, which are the Zen chapters. But apparently they're completely reappraising those, completely redesigning them.
All right.
They said they're upgrading the engine themselves now in order to allow them to make Zen what they want it to be.
Right.
They talked about it being much more organic in style than the Source engine is typically capable of, which is kind of super interesting that they are going that far.
When you're saying that the Source engine is dated a bit, I started to realise, like, God, wouldn't it be so awful if you set out to remake the old game in the new game's engine, and it takes you so long that by the time you finish, the new engine is too outdated.
Yeah, well, it's 10 years
Source 2 comes out. and you're like, well, now we've got to port it to Source 2, because...
Are they saying that stuff about Zen because they are now selling it and Zen won't be available to... Are they kind of bigging it up as a selling
point? I don't
it's hard to get think, people excited about Zen, isn't it?
I think they're probably selling it so they can afford to hire people to do more stuff. And I think they have done quite a bit between the mod that was free.
Yeah.
And, like, I think they've... Obviously, with Valve's
There's a huge list of changes. They are the things that would be meaningless for me to spool out, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I do credit them. I mean, like, they've done an amazing job, really, so far, and it's been a 10-year project for them.
Yeah.
Which is fucking insane, really. Yeah. And to have that commitment, and to get to the standard that they have. I know that a lot of them are now video game professionals, but when they started, they weren't all necessarily, I don't think.
No.
And the game as released is stands, you know, beside Half-Life 2 and its episodes quite happily.
Mm.
But what's interesting, as I said this in the piece for RPS, is that actually, what it does is it upgrades the original game to the standard that I have a memory of it. because as with lots of things in childhood, your experiences of them are, because everything is new to you when you're a stupid child, your experiences of things are that much kind of enlarged and exaggerated, and you have a greater kind of emotional response to things, I think. And as you get older, that response is really what you remember and not the actuality of the original thing. And I've gone back to games, retro games, that I play as a kid now and just been like, what the fuck is this? Like, not because they're bad now or because they're unplayable anyway, but because literally visually, I have a recollection of them as being these much more sophisticated and amazing things. And what they are is incredibly crude. But my memory, you know, when I was a child, I superimposed all this imagination upon them. And that has actually just completely concreted in my feeble, dying brain over the years. and the same thing happened with Half-Life. And certainly because I've gone back to Half-Life so many times, I've been able to kind of keep, some kind of check on my imagination of it. But actually, this game kind of brings it up to the standard that I remember it being, you know? And that's really kind of... I don't know, it's not nostalgia, there needs to be a new word for it, where it's some kind of fantasy version of what you recall. I don't know.
I had that with Rune, which is a
third-person
Viking action. You get a big axe and you chop stuff up.
Yeah, I remember that game.
Yeah.
Who made that?
Amazing memories of that. And then I went back and played that recently.
Yeah, that's that. Unreal Engine, wasn't it? Really big polygonal blocks of snow.
Oh, yeah. It's like, Unreal, the original Unreal is a terrible, terrible one.
I know. I still have enough kind of love of that game that I can go back to it now.
I do love that game, but
because it's mechanically really sound.
Hmm.
And in fact, actually, that's one of the interesting things about Half-Life, the Black Mesa recreation of it, is that it's not a very good shooter, and it's at its best when you aren't really doing much shooting. Like, it's really good. The first few hours are brilliant because you're stalking through these destroyed labs and these kind of wrecked environments, which is kind of the, you know, the kind of familiar feel of them made unfamiliar, which is, you know, in itself quite scary. But you occasionally bushwhack by enemies and things like that, but they, at that stage, they're all aliens and they all have a very great deal of asymmetry to the way they attack you. None of them, are kind of the hit scan bullet firing enemies that you find later on with the soldiers. And that's actually far more satisfying because you have at your disposal a range of choices about how you approach them because they each have their own kind of vulnerabilities and methods of attack. So you've got kind of bull squids who fire at you from afar. And obviously you need to choose whether you kind of take out the enemies who are in your immediate range or you take out this thing which is just going to bombard you with really damaging kind of acid puke. And then you've got the Vortigaunts, who I don't think are named Vortigaunts actually in Half-Life 1. I think that's the name. Anyway, they have this wind up and they fire a kind of laser shot. But you've got a couple of seconds which you can either take them out during if you manage to sustain the amount of fire on them, or you need to duck behind cover, and then you've got head crabs jumping at you and barnacles kind of catching at you. And it's a really interesting mix of enemies because it really forces you to start with to keep on moving. You need to be thinking about sight lines and how to break sight lines and how to gain sight lines on enemies. You also need to be aware of where all these kind of things are that are snapping at your heels, like the head crabs, whether like a slow moving zombie is going to get in range and fuck you up, whether you can deal with all this kind of other immediate threat. And it's like, it's really intense, like the way it engages your brain, because you're really kind of thinking hard about your positioning and priorities. And then when you get to the soldiers, which I remember actually being like a shot in the arm for the game when I played it originally, it's really boring. They're really boring to fight. They're like, and there's, occasionally they throw grenades at you badly. But most of the time, they just shoot at you. And it's like,
yeah, I remember liking them because they would do things that I hadn't really seen enemies do before in games, like take cover.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you shot them, they would limp off and try and hide and ziplining in from ceilings and stuff like that. And also, I really liked that they would also fight with the aliens. And I don't know if Black Mesa does the same, but Half-Life mixed in both at the same time. And so you would be... It was another addition to your thought process in terms of prioritizing which enemies you were going to take out first.
Yeah.
Because you knew that soldiers would kill some of them, or the aliens would kill some of the soldiers, and that sort of stuff. And I think you criticised them in your piece, but I liked the kind of lady stealth ninjas.
Oh, yeah.
That were, you know, soldiers, but they would jump around, and they would jump on top of the, you know, two-story high crates and stuff like that.
I see all those things, and I think those are the things that I found attractive about the soldiers,
17 years ago?
Yeah, 17 years ago. But since then, like, military shooters have really improved upon the way that soldier AI works. And Half-Life 2 blows those soldiers out of the water in a lot of ways with the Combine soldiers. And in this, it seems like you're really... I mean, they do sort of take cover, but most of the time they just kind of mill about. And all you're doing is, and compared to the kind of calculations you're doing when you're fighting the aliens, the only calculation you need to make when you're fighting the humans is what is their kind of accuracy percentage and how long am I going to be within their view? And it just ends up being this kind of exchange of hit scan weaponry, which doesn't feel terribly satisfying. The thing that Half-Life 2 really improves upon Half-Life 1's combat with is the fact that it has a limited dash, and it means that because in Half-Life 1 I was playing, I'd actually forgotten that it was an infinite dash. I'm not sure if it is, maybe it isn't, I don't know, but in Black Mesa it is. You just hold down shift, you can run forever. And to begin with, it doesn't really have a lot of kind of facility in combat, so I just found it really liberating. Oh, brilliant, I get to walk to the end of the room quicker, you know, and that's kind of fun. But when you get to the soldiers and it is this exchange of hit-scan weaponry, there's really no tactical significance to it. Whereas if you have a dash, you need to... It suddenly becomes a lot more key about how far you can move and the pacing and the kind of, you know, am I going to be able to reach that guy with a shotgun and shoot him, or am I going to run out of breath halfway and be in a kill zone? You know, that becomes like a really significant and exciting decision in Half-Life 2. but it's not there in this. And I wonder if some of this stuff could be solved by the fact that you have actually really exciting armory in Half-Life 1. Like, you've got crazy fucking weapons. You've got this tau cannon, which is kind of fires a kind of percussive series of shots, so you can kind of power it up to fire one single blast. And you've got the gluon gun very late on, which is like a Ghostbusters cannon. You've got a fucking hand that fires wasps and snarks, which are like these little kind of living grenades. Which
I
love
really
snarks.
They're great. They were fucking great in multiplayer as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. There is multiplayer in Black Mesa as well, but I haven't tried it yet. But you don't really get to use that stuff in Black Mesa. Like, it's there, but it's never. There's never really a situation forced upon you, or that you're encouraged into, where you need to use it. Because my instinct is anyway to save up the good stuff for when things get dire. But even with that kind of mental deficiency in mind, I think Black Mesa doesn't do enough to kind of encourage you through its kind of item drops, through the amount of ammunition you have for each of these things. And also the MP5, which is your kind of, you know, generic shooty machine gun thing, it's just way more accurate than Half-Life 2's. It's like a really good sniping weapon, basically. It's great close range, great long range. There's loads of ammunition for it because all the soldiers drop it all the time. And you basically, as soon as you pick that up, you rarely put it down, like even in favour of the shotgun or anything else, or even the kind of Magnum. And I think if they address that balance in some way and make you use the arsenal, then a lot of the problems I have with those kind of, just the relentless kind of soldier sections will disappear, I think.
They could have presumably given those soldiers Combine AI. So the Combine basically behaved like better people. Though I guess a lot of the environments of Half-Life 2 are designed to give the Combine the space to actually outmaneuver you.
I don't know if they don't have the Combine AI. Right. Maybe they may well do, but as you say, like, I think a lot of it is to do with the environments. Yeah. One of the things that happens in Half-Life 2 a lot is, especially on that coastal road. I mean, Half-Life 2 is interesting because you rarely end up going to a place to have a fight. You are, for the first 2 hours, running away from the Combine soldiers. And that's important in terms of how that their AI or deficiencies thereof is disguised. Because you don't really need to engage them in the same way that you would if you're walking into a room and there's like 8 soldiers there and you gun them down. And even then, like if you think about the places along the coastal road and places like that, where they end up encircling like a building that you're in.
Yeah.
You know, you that's immediately an interesting tactical proposition, which doesn't really happen in confined spaces of Black Mesa. And it's very linear, always kind of just punching through kind of clumps of soldiers along the way, which again doesn't feel like that in Half-Life 2, even though that's probably kind of the way they're set up. A lot of them kind of fights feel incidental in Half-Life 2. Yeah. Like you can kind of,
it does a lot of ambushing you in Half-Life 2. Very often you know, like on the Highway 17, you'd be driving along the road and then there'd be a force field and you stop at the force field and then the Combine turn out to be in the buildings or they arrive or something.
But they come from lots of different sides.
Yeah, exactly.
That's when their AI really shines because they're moving into windows and, you know, they're not all moving in the same way. They're all actually actively trying to insert you, which is amazing.
And there's always a mix as well. Like, I mean, I didn't really see this behaviour in Black Mesa, but the shotgun guys in Half-Life 2 definitely try and get up close, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the episodes, obviously you have the hunters as well.
Yeah,
and
great.
That's a great kind of combination. Which only happens with the alien enemies in Black Mesa. Mm. But yeah, it's still fucking great. It's an amazing, how all of its shooter mechanics have endured really beyond so many years of iteration.
Do they take the Vortigaunts from Half-Life 2 and put them in this, or have
they
made their own Vortigaunts?
They were in Half-Life 1. But I mean,
these model.
The model.
I'm saying, did they copy the model across?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it's a really high-poly model, so I assume it's the one from Half-Life 2.
It's funny, because I've, you know, fought with them loads, but I haven't fought them in any part of Half-Life 2. So the idea of actually shooting them is kind of weird to me.
Yeah, well, the lore is that they're enslaved in some way. But I think one of the weird things about up-resing it is that there's kind of like, if you remember the opening to Half-Life, it's actually quite funny. It's pretty hammy, you know, go into the test chamber, Gordon, you know, and this kind of these scientists babbling about resonance cascade scenarios and things like that. It's obviously meant to be kind of like, I don't know.
The movie.
Schlocky. Yeah, schlocky, yeah. Definitely. And you can see that in the creature design as well. I forget the name of the guy who was responsible for a lot of that stuff, but he left out between the two projects. And you can see that big kind of cycloptic muscle thing that attacks you in the in the railway, which has these kind of two giant kind of clam shaped hands which fire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Garg is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a naff looking design. It's like something from like a Doctor Who comic. Whereas you have Ted Backman, who takes on the creature design largely for Half-Life 2, and he has a really sinister fucking idea about... he's the one who drove through a lot of the ideas about the kind of non-consensual transhumanism which occurs with the advent of the Combine, and all these sinister things, and things that have kind of quite sexual imagery as well. I suppose the Gonark from the original Half-Life, there's a hint of that, but then you have a lot of, like, fucking penile tendrils in Half-Life 2, and there's a lot about the human race has had its sexuality kind of put to an end by some kind of weird field. And there's lots of kind of like, you know, sinister stuff going on there, which is kind of more than the kind of cartoon thing with big teeth, which is going on in Half-Life 1. But what's strange about this upgrade is that Black Mesa purloins some of the models from Half-Life 2 for Half-Life 1. And some of them are just kind of too gross, really, for that world. Like the zombies, the headcrab zombies, in Half-Life 1, I said they weren't scary. Maybe they were scary in Half-Life 1, but also they were kind of ridiculous. And, you didn't feel too bad about it when you beat the shit out of them with a crowbar, but in this you knock the kind of headcrab off, and you've got this kind of horrible, bleached, fucking frayed flesh of this kind of ghastly death visage beneath, and this shattered skull and exposed half eaten brain, and it's just it's absolutely disgusting. I don't know. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel quite as funny.
I think in Half-Life 1 they would just kind of make like gribbly noises, and this, whereas in Half-Life 2 they scream with an English in English hear the human inside, kill me, that kind of stuff, especially when they catch fire.
Yeah, these creatures are horribly, horribly tormented, and somehow, seeing this, I mean, you know, it still has the same kind of jokes of scientists being sucked into vents and then puked out as gibs, but,
Does it still have the little, adorable dog things?
Hound eyes, yeah. I always felt bad about killing them.
Yeah, me too.
They gib really nicely now. I have a theory that, the hunters in Half-Life 2 are the kind of the experimented on kind of souped up version of the Hound Eyes. Mm-hmm. Like the Combine's come in and decided this species isn't good enough, we're going to improve upon this.
Upgrades, give more legs.
Mm.
Put on the stilts.
Yeah.
They do have three legs, do they?
Yeah. Anyway, so that's good. That's nice. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been away for 3 weeks, so I've played a lot. And I want to talk a little bit about two things, Broken Age and Wolfenstein. Broken Age I've now finished, and I was really excited about part two, and I wouldn't say I thoroughly enjoyed part one. I would say that I was very invested in the story. The concept of it is only revealed at the end of part one, and it's a twist, and I loved the twist. The twist totally worked for me. It was just perfectly pitched where I just should have grasped it but didn't. Loads of people saw it coming, I didn't. And it's also a massive cliffhanger for like what's going to happen next. But I've also been watching the Double Fine documentary, and that is, I can't remember what part they're on now. I feel like it's like part 20 or something ridiculous. Like I've watched dozens of hours of the development of that game, and that's why I backed it on Kickstarter in the first place, was to watch the documentary. The idea of them making an old school adventure game wasn't even appealing in theory. I don't want to play an old school adventure game because I didn't like the puzzles in those games, and like basically as games they were almost all fundamentally broken. And
hence the name Broken Age.
But you know, they were sometimes incredibly imaginative and funny and brilliant, and so I wasn't interested in really the game so much as watching it be made. And I knew that when I did play the game, I'd play it with a walkthrough, if humanly possible. and just kind of enjoy it for the story. But the documentary has been brilliant. Certainly, I paid like $15 for this, and it's been an ongoing like saga for, has it been 2 years or something like that? And so I've already had far more than my money's worth before even the first part of the game came out. And then the first part of the game I really enjoyed, so I got my money's worth out of that. And then it's been really interesting to watch how it's gone on since then. But watching the documentary has left me very glad I'm not a games journalist and very glad I'm not reviewing Broken Age Part 2 or Broken Age as a whole, because I don't like the puzzles. I knew I wouldn't. In fact, they're, if anything, worse than I imagined when I was thinking about what old-school adventure game puzzles were like. And to reiterate, I just don't like old-school adventure game puzzles at all. There are no good ones as far as I know. And these are unusually convoluted and difficult. But I don't feel like, I'm glad I don't have to write a really long article about why and really lay into it, because it is, there are lots of things that I can talk about, that I could talk about in depth about why these puzzles don't work and why I think they're badly designed, but I don't want to after seeing how hard it was to make and how much pain they went through to produce it, and I just feel kind of really bad for them and think, well, it's a really beautiful game, I broadly enjoyed most of the story, and it's sometimes funny, and lovely to look at. So, yeah, if you're a critic, you shouldn't watch behind-the-scenes stuff in too much depth, because it could become almost impossible to criticise.
Was it obvious from watching the documentary that there was a reason why they made a shit game in the end?
I don't think it's a shit game. I think it's a game of terrible
games. I was being mean, really. But I mean, they've made quite a lot of shit games recently, which are genuinely just duff in some ways, or unfinished, and they seem to have some kind of production problem going on at Double Fine, I would say, from playing the games. Is that borne out by the documentary?
The documentary suggests they made a very serious mistake a long time ago with the Kickstarter thing, where they got 10 times as much money as they asked for, and so they felt they couldn't make the small scope thing that they said they were going to make, because if they did that, they would be yelled at by the community for, like, what the fuck, you got $3 million, why are you going to make a $300,000 game? Although I don't know if the community really have a sense of what a $300,000 game is. And so they scaled it up intentionally, thinking, well, we've got to make something on a much bigger scale. But probably $3 million was a good estimate for what it would have cost them to make the thing they thought they could make for $300,000.
right.
And so it's been, you know, as hard as if they were making a $3 million game on a $300,000 budget. Like, they've had to keep compromising, keep getting funding from other sources, keep committing to platforms because the platform owner will, you know, help fund, and I think that's the case. And certainly seek outside investment and release the first half of the game on its by itself just to keep the studio going. And I'm always, for a long time watching it, I'm always kind of yelling at Tim Schafer on the screen, because he's always saying, like, he's the one always saying, like, oh, we'll get it done by the end of the year. And everyone's like, no, Tim, no. You can see it before he does that it's just not going to happen. And he's like, yeah, but it's like, he was justifying, like, he kept saying, well, we'll get it done by December. And then I think the interviewer kind of questioned him about, well, no one else seems to think it's going to be done by December. And he says, yeah, but they're saying, like, January. And I'm like, if we get it done by January, then surely we just get it done by December. It's just like, oh, that's sooner. Like, why is that such a good deal? And so I was always kind of, he's just, like, delusional. He's too obsessed with the idea of getting it done by this particular time and not listening to what people are telling him. And then at some point he says that he's talking about, like, it's really difficult to get people to take their internal deadlines seriously. When they're working for a publisher and the publisher is giving them milestones, it's literally a case of if you don't deliver this chunk of content to the publisher for approval by that date, you don't get paid, and then the payments are such that the entire studio goes under. So it's literally life or death. When that was the case, everyone took it seriously because they knew the whole studio depended on it. And then he's saying that, like, when it's our own internal things that we think we need to get it done by this date, then people are like, well, you know, it's our date, so it's, they can slip a bit. And so, yeah, sort of sympathize with that. Like, it's, you know, annoying because when you're running a studio, you're the guy who can see that this is life or death. Like, we might actually go under if we don't hit that date. And it gets to that point pretty much. It gets to the point where, like, they're discussing, I think he's talking about, like, it's not Tim, but someone else is talking about, like, is there anyone, like, this final stretch, we're gonna, like, if we need to ask for an extension from the people who are printing the discs, if they can't print it, then the whole deal falls through. Is there anyone we can pull from any other projects? And the other guy says, like, our other projects, if we don't deliver those, the studio closes. So no, we can't spare anyone from any other projects. So it really is like on the absolute brink of death, which is terrifying and weird for a company that does games that are well liked generally and that and makes a lot of them. Like,
well, not recently. I mean, Space-Based DF9 was.
Yeah, not that one, but Costume Quest is always well liked. Stacking, I remember getting really good reviews. Grim Fandango, I hear, is a popular game. They just released that again.
Yeah.
I just, I watched a few episodes of the documentary as they were going up, and it had kind of put it to one side, but over the last 3 weeks or so, I watched the first 11 or 12 episodes, around about half of it, and it's remarkable how quick they run into these problems. It's like, you know, like the first episode is all about them setting up the Kickstarter and launching the Kickstarter and it this being this great success. And by about episode 3 or 4, they've brought in a producer to help with the money stuff who's telling them, you can't afford to make the game that you're making. You're going to have to cut all this stuff. And Tim Schafer's really upset about all the stuff they're going to have to cut. And then by like the end of episode 4 or beginning of episode 5, it's like, well, thankfully we've just found this guy who help us release Brutal Legend on PC so we can get some money to help us make Broken Age. It's like, you just had this phenomenally successful Kickstarter project that you got far more money than you were asking for and immediately dove headfirst into, like, it's the thing that you just said, but it's how quickly and voluntarily they rushed into those problems that's bizarre. And then there's, I mean, if he was mean to lay blame at the feet of individuals, but like you can watch the process by which they make that game and see all the ways in which that process is fragile to design errors slipping in. And I think they do like a playtest in episode 7 where it's really early days for the game and people point out flaws with it, which the reviews are pointing out now for Broken Age Act 2 as they're coming out. Like, stuff like people not being able to tell sometimes between foreground and background items or which items are interactive. Like, what are the things that in this room that I can click on? Like, someone says that in a very early episode, but you can tell by the way that their process is set up for making games, they're not set up to adapt or respond in any of the ways that you need to be in order for those things to happen.
Some of the, you get a better insight into why they might have been tempted to push towards a bigger scale thing, when, for some reason, it's their lead sound guy is kind of the most brutally honest one, who's just like, who gets quite emotional about it and just says that he basically says that they're all, dreaming of this one thing that they do that is successful enough they just don't have to worry for a while. And he just says they've been struggling just for so long and they're just desperate to get into a situation where one thing just breaks out and does well enough that you can just relax, because that is all it takes. You know, you just need one thing that's, when something's successful, it's, you know, not twice as successful, it's 10 times as successful. And on this scale, that would just solve all their problems for years to come.
Should they have made this documentary, which seems to have laid bare a lot of the flaws of their working processes?
Yeah, it's not like they're going to get a lot of publisher investment, you'd think, at this stage. Surely a publisher would just watch this again.
Well, I think this is just, you know, what a publisher sees any time they look at a creative person. Can I give milestones to
I don't know, it's surely hard to find.
They don't seem incompetent, is the thing. They don't seem like, they seem right. Like talented, intelligent people with perhaps a structure to the process which is flawed, but it doesn't seem like they don't seem like buffoons or anything like that. But this seems like, there's a kind of, there's some feeling of inevitability to the decisions that they are actively making, which is strange.
I think the reason it's hard for them to produce enough and have enough success to support themselves is that they just have a lot of people. Mm. And apparently, Tim is just incredibly reluctant to let anyone go. And they did have a round of redundancy recently, but it wasn't, when I heard that, I thought, having watched the documentary, I thought, well, maybe, you know, they've sat down and looked at the studio structure and just thought, like, shit, we just burn money so fucking fast. It's insane to ever be able to produce enough successful games to support this. But no, it was that they had an unannounced project was cancelled by the publisher. At the same, it was two different things, both publishers screwing them over. And one of them was a thing that they were talking about didn't happen, and another thing was cancelled in the middle of production, and the people who were assigned to work on that, there's just literally no money in the budget to pay them anymore. And so it all fell through, like, really suddenly. It wasn't, like, a sort of decision to, oh, maybe we should be more efficient for future reference. It's just like, well, we literally can't afford to employ the people we have now, so they let them go. Mm. But yeah, it's a terrifying thing. Really stressful to watch, too, because it's like, it's all the problems of game development, but you can't do anything about them.
I think it justifies the entire endeavor for me. Like, whether Broken Age was any good or not, I feel like everyone should watch the documentary. I think it's a really valuable insight, whether you want to make games or not. Because I don't think there's ever been anything which has laid bare the development process. Yeah. So, hugely.
Reminds me of, everyone should check out the documentary that was attached to Star Wars Episode 1. There's a very good hour-long documentary, which surprisingly, it was included as a DVD extra, surprisingly critical, and surprisingly just quite... I'm amazed that George Lucas has clearly never seen it. I'll just say that. it's absolutely fantastic to watch that thing go wrong, and there's a moment towards the end of it where Lucas and all of the senior kind of producers are in a cinema and they watch the first cut, and even George Lucas knows it's broken. And he just turns around and is like, I can't fix it, there's too many knots, I can't cut this without affecting this, and they just know it's gone wrong after this multi-million dollar process. And it traces back to the first scene where George Lucas is going through the storyboard, he's like, that's CG, that's real, he's got two marker pens and he's doing one in pink and one in yellow, and then he gets the two mixed up halfway through and the guys, like, the camera pans over to the guys behind him and they're just like shaking their heads. this is on YouTube, and we'll link it in the show notes if we can find it, because it's very good.
Oh yeah. Sounds good.
Do you feel, having watched that, less willing to criticise Phantom Menace? Does it feel like...
No, I'm really willing to commit to hating the Phantom Menace. It's just a bad piece of work. I always think, you know, I do feel sympathy sometimes for the creative people behind these things, but they're charging money for them. Quite a lot of money sometimes. You know, it's like £60 for these things. But
yeah,
if you're there to represent the consumer, then it's just,
I think you can compartmentalise this stuff. Like, I mean, I've done some real shit in my time. You know, I've banged out some stuff. And it was never because I wanted to do that. It's because whatever, you know, power structure in which I was horribly trapped prevented me from doing my best work. And I'd hope that people would, you know, people who are my peers and people who know me would look at the stuff that I did then and think, well, that was shit, but, you know, he'd the best under the circumstances. But I don't blame people for, you know, in imbibing that stuff and then spitting it right back out again, because it was total shit.
Yeah.
I think pretty sure I've seen that Phantom Menace documentary, and it's good, but it's an hour long, whereas this being cool. Over the months... And you get to know the people behind it, I think, probably much more, and sort of feel their excitement and optimism and joy and struggles, and it humanizes them to a much greater degree.
I see them sometimes at events, and when I do, I'm like, oh, my old friend! And they're like, no, this person's never spoken to me. I have no idea who I am. But yeah, you do feel really, really strong sympathy for me.
I think the equivalent of the Broken Age documentary sound guy is like the... an editor in the Star Wars Episode 1 documentary, where George Lucas is like, because he's doing composite shots where he's taking half of, like, a guy from one shot and superimposing his acting performance on into another shot. And then he leaves the room, and the guy just turns around and goes, I don't know about this modern shit, and, like, I just think actors should act, you know? Just, like, directly undermines him seconds after George Lucas is left the room. It's amazing stuff.
There was one moment, at least, like that, in the Double Fine documentary where Tim Schafer, I think, is listening to the first maybe attempt at like a little bit of music score for a trailer, and Tim saying, oh, it's got to be more of this, you've got to change that, change this, and then Tim leaves the room and the musician turns to like a producer that's there and is like, you know, so like, what should I do this? And the producer's just like, don't worry about it. if Tim's really serious about it, he'll tell me again. So just leave it, yeah. Leave it as it is. And this is like the score for the reveal trailer, the first time they'd ever shown off the game, which I think they did at like GDC or E3 or something like that. I think GDC, I think it was, because Tim Schafer presents it up on stage. And there's like a close-up of Tim Schafer's face as he's watching the trailer on this giant screen, and I just can't, like, I'm wondering, is he listening to the score and noticing like, these guys just didn't do
it? I hope that's not the first time he's hearing it.
Yeah.
Sounds
fantastic.
I've been talking terrible. I have to review music from composers, and I'm just a fucking idiot. I just don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'll ask for changes, and I'll change it, and I'll get the new version back, and I'll go, oh, I don't like this. Why have they done this? And I'll look at my email, because I asked them to. What's wrong with me?
You wanted to talk about Wolfenstein as well.
Oh, yeah.
Is this the Old Blood?
No, the new order, the old one.
Oh, right. The new old one, yeah.
Not the new old one, the old new one.
Of course, yeah.
I just got around to it. I think because people were talking about the Old Blood and it just reminded me, oh, yeah, that's on my... I have that installed ever since it came out and I still haven't played it. And, yeah, everyone said it was good, and it is. And I was surprised that it was basically a stealth game. I didn't realise that. It's kind of... There are lots of sections in which you can either shoot your way through them or be stealthy. And if you shoot your way through them, it's pretty much a conventional shooter. But it's got this really simple system that it reuses throughout, as far as I played, where one of the tricky things is, like, if you're ever going to mix stealth and combat, is particularly if there's sections where you simply can't do it in a stealthy way, is how do you tell the player that? How, without, you know, signposting it in a really crude way, how do you say, this bit can be done stealthily? Because if they find one bit where they can't do it stealthily, then they just assume, oh, it's not a stealth game, they just play action all the way through. But the way they do that in this is that there are, in any area where stealth is possible, there will be a commander who has a radio thing, and as soon as you're in range of that guy, a HUD element pops up showing you his, like, radio signal, just so you know he's around, and if he's ever alerted, then he'll call for reinforcements, and he'll keep calling for reinforcements until you kill him. And if anyone else is alerted, then that doesn't matter so much, but obviously they can alert each other, and that can spread pretty quickly to the commander. So it's kind of like, stay stealthy until you've taken this guy out, and then maybe shoot everyone. Or when I play it, I'm just like, okay, it's a stealth area, so I'm just literally never going to get spotted. I'm going to take out everybody silently. And you can sneak up on people, do a melee takedown, you know, instantly. And then later you get the ability to throw your knives. It's got quite an unusual perk system where it's almost like achievements, and when you perform certain achievements, you unlock new perks. Just automatically, you don't choose which one you get. You just get the perk for that achievement. So throwing knives is one you get for being stealthy. Like, you get a certain number of stealth kills, I think, and then you're allowed to throw your knives. And that's always great. There's never a time when throwing knives isn't brilliant. So it's kind of like you're sneaking up on people and usually trying to get a stealth takedown, but then if you realize, shit, I don't have time for this, I've got to, you know, dodge this other guy, then you start throwing knives. And I became obsessed with unlocking all of the... throwing knife slots. You don't need them at all, because really, if you've got two knives, then you can throw one of them, and I think you're never allowed to throw your last knife, because you need one to do melee attacks. So if you have two, you can throw one, and then you get it straight back from the guy. So there's no real advantage to having four. Particularly once you've got four, there's no reason to have five, but for the last perk to get that fifth knife slot, I did ridiculous things. So yeah, I was just really enjoying a stealth game. And then I got to a bit where there's a stealth section like that, and once you've cleared it out, you have to turn a crank to open a door, and the door is right in front of you, and you have to continue turning it, like, hold the button. And inside that room is a, like, mech robot thing that's like a boss, and so it automatically sees you. There's no way for it not to see you, because you're literally standing in front of it when you open it. And then it killed me like three times in a row, and I was like, fuck this game forever.
Wow, I certainly don't remember that bit. Are you sure there's no alternative way to?
It's literally, your objective is to turn that crank. Turn that crank.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't automatically kill you, obviously. It just, like, he sees you and shoots you a bit, and then you get away, if you like. And then it's just a boss fight, and I just don't like boss fights, and you know, probably don't have the tolerance to get through it.
Oh well. That game consigned to history then. Don't play The Old Blood though, it's rubbish. As we discussed last week.
I heard bad things.
Should we do questions from the land of questions?
Yes, we should.
Which is where the questions dwell.
Isaac Nunn writes, "Hi guys, love the podcast, you're my favourite people to listen to."
Aww.
Bad news for all the people in your real life. "I was interested to find the following interactive on the BBC website along with its election coverage." And then he drops a link that we've put in the show notes. "It's a rudimentary game that generates a random election result with a hung parliament, if only, and the player has to create an alliance of parties that would be able to get a majority in the House of Commons. There are several things about this that I'd be interested in hearing your opinions on. Firstly, is it encouraging that serious news organisations are using games like this to supplement their news coverage? While it is a very short interactive experience, I think it is a game, as opposed to an interactive graph, because it provides the player with a goal and has the element of randomness to encourage experimentation. I think it shows that people in general are starting to see the value of games to give people insights into how systems work. Secondly, do you think that this use of simple games to illustrate ideas will become more widespread in the media? How far can it go? Will the BBC ever make a full-on first-person election simulator 2015? Would it be useful? Perhaps more importantly, do you think that small experiences like this can be influential or powerful? I'd like to hear if you think that games like this can have an impact on the way people think about, in this instance, politics in the UK. Thanks for reading, Isaac."
Yes!
Well, moving swiftly on.
I'd love to see more of this stuff investigated through games. I think Democracy was, although it's flawed in a lot of ways in that you can... the game Democracy, I should say.
Democracy 3.
Yeah, it's flawed in a lot of ways, and you can kind of exploit some of its quirks. But it also, what it does is it does help explicate a lot of the ways in which different policies are interlinked in a way which is very sophisticated and does a better job than pretty much the entire history of human media has done. Wow. in terms of expressing that stuff. That game, I think it's really valuable. I think
The thing that the BBC does.
I think it's kind of a cute way of showing exactly how parties can be cobbled together to form a majority. But what it is, it just randomizes a number and then you have to add other numbers to it to get over a certain number. So there's not a lot of tactics to it, but it does give you, as you are adding these parties together to reach the maximum that you need, it does tell you stuff about them and the decisions that their leadership have made, which make it more or less likely for them to want to join a coalition. But there's no kind of like complexity to that. Like, it isn't harder for you to add the DUP than it is to add the Lib Dems to your Labour Party, even though obviously the DUP would probably not be an obvious stablemate for Labour.
It would be interesting if they'd, you know, given each party like relationships to the other parties,
yes,
and then you had to have some kind of bartering mechanic.
But
where
the
you
thing
could,
is,
like, trade policies.
They couldn't do that without breaking their impartiality, because I don't think there's a way that. I mean, maybe there. It wouldn't. It's not really a stretch to say that, like, a UKIP Labour coalition would probably be fairly disastrous for both parties. But I don't know if the BBC could say that with their impartiality required.
I think also that demands an extra layer of programming complexity. I think the main limiting factor, you see loads, this is an increasing phenomenon, like people creating interactive graphs.
Yeah.
Or interactive, or even just BuzzFeed making, like, and quizzes and, you know, the various ways they're trying to do quick media content. But the tools are the limiting factor at the moment. And tools are getting better and better and better, as we've seen from, like, puzzle scripts and stuff like that. But I think they'll have to improve even more if news organizations are going to turn around these things very quickly and actually make relevant topical games. Like, the tools are going to have to take another leap in usability so that journalists can actually program games at the same time.
I feel like we mentioned it in a previous podcast.
Yeah, I've mentioned one in, like, there are journalists who are trying to create news reports that are virtual environments, explorable environments, and I think that's a genuinely interesting avenue to be pursued. The idea that you've got these correspondents interviewing and recording the sound of people in places like Aleppo, and the idea that you could create an environment where you use photographic composites to create Aleppo and then have people in it that you talk to and you hear their voices is just a really direct way of documenting those experiences that without the kind of the lens of the writer in between you and the people and the places. Like you're seeing all those images and you're hearing those voices, and that's kind of very just, it's, even though it's a virtual environment, it feels to me like a very direct and honest way of reporting. And I'm really interested in that area. Yeah. But again, huge resources required to create a virtual environment and do all that stuff.
Yeah, I think that like immersion in a place is a thing that games can do, and that an interactive sort of demonstration thing can do. Like you could make something that's definitely not a game that does that.
Yeah.
For a news report that would be really valuable and cool. But one thing games, or like interactive systems at least, can only do is kind of modeling mechanics. So that coalition thing is an interesting idea, but I think probably one of the problems there is it's just not a complex enough problem for it to be super interesting to solve that.
It's adding numbers
to
other numbers.
There's a really good simulation by Vi Hart. I don't know her. She does a great series of like maths videos on YouTube, kind of playing with maths and numbers. And she and somebody else whose name I forget did a interactive sort of, it is really a game, but I guess more of a simplified simulation of how biases for and against diversity affect the segregation of a community. And it's literally just yellow and blue people in a grid, and they randomly distribute them, and then they say, okay, if let's give them a behavior that says a person is slightly unhappy if they are surrounded by less than half of their own kind. So if more than half of the people around them are of the other colour, then they will try and move away and try and get further towards their people. Which is actually quite a weak bias. That's like, I'm happy to have like 40% of the people around me be completely different to me, but I'd rather it wasn't 60%. And if you run that simulation continuously, very quickly, the whole society becomes completely segregated. It's just all yellows on one side, all blues on the other side.
Oh, wow.
And if you give them if you leave them neutral, obviously nothing happens at all, and they stay randomly distributed, or if they're already segregated, then they stay segregated. And if only some of them have that bias and some of them have no opinion at all, then you end up with segregation. And everything leads to segregation unless you have a very slight bias towards diversity. If you give them someone just would rather be not, like it's not 50-50, it's, if you give them a bias that says, I don't want to be completely surrounded by my own kind. I'd like at least one other person around me who's not totally the same as me. And you add that, then suddenly the whole thing becomes completely diversified and people mingle much more readily and it becomes really evenly distributed.
Total neutrality doesn't get the same result.
No. Yeah, you have to have a bias towards diversity, but it just needs to be very slight and then it can overturn huge existing segregation. If you're a series of tiny sprites in a grid, that would be really...
It's all I want to be, man.
But it's one of those things where, like, it's not trying to really model the actual situation. The actual situation is absurdly complex and can never be modelled. But it just illustrates a point and just says, small biases lead to massive change.
The principle, yeah.
I don't think that's the purpose of... I don't think you can ever have a situation which is perfectly modelled in a video game. I don't think that's actually the point. I the reason that Democracy 3 is useful is not that it's a perfect model of the way that democracy actually works. But it does point out interrelations between things that you just might not have occurred to you. And that's really valuable. That stuff just doesn't occur to you, you know. And if you're an ignorant fool, such as myself. But did we mention that Dan Grill did a series of really excellent, extremely funny articles in which he put put the various candidate parties' manifestos through Democracy 3 and worked out what kind of Britain resulted from that. Not a good one in most cases, it seemed.
I really enjoyed his one for the Greens, where he was so hopeful it started so well and the country was destroyed. They're all really good, though. We'll link those in the show notes.
Yeah. Simulation, it was called. Yeah. It was a new statesman.
You could see somebody paying for that to be built. I'd really love some of the BBC's, obviously the BBC's going to be destroyed before this could possibly happen at the next election, but thanks to the Tory government.
It's going to be 5 years of podcast listeners just getting frustrated with
Sorry to all our right-wing listeners. I'd love to see some of the money that goes towards the BBC and also Channel 4 going towards games because that seems like a legitimate medium of expression.
Yeah, Channel 4 have commissioned some, like, they commissioned a sex education game.
They did, yeah. They commissioned Film City from Big Robot, which is the game I worked on.
Yeah.
The BBC still make games.
They did Doctor Who. Way back,
They do that sort of stuff, but they also do, like, they did a bunch of stuff around the anniversary of World War One. It's been celebrated at the moment. And like,
what I was going to say is I'd love to see them partly fund some kind of, like, modded version of Democracy. I imagine Klifsky, who makes Democracy, is probably too expensive for them. But
I think he has done in the past versions of Democracy for government bodies or think tanks or something like that. Certainly he's mentioned publicly, I think, being contacted by those kinds of people.
They need to get in contact with him and Dan Grill, and those two can work out together what is exactly needed for Dan Grill to better simulate actual democracy. I'd like to see that.
They were
for the next one.
Working together, weren't they, I think?
Yeah, 5 years, come on. You can get it done. You can get it done in that time.
Seth Benzel writes, "Dear Command and Conquer, long-time listener, first-time emailer. In the previous episode, a questioner asked about the significance of Dr. Robotnik's moniker. I would like to inform you that the reference, in fact, goes one level deeper than your conversation implied. As a matter of fact, the term robot comes to us from the Czech term robotai, for forced labour via the early science fiction play R.U.R. As an aside, spoiler alert, this play also gives us the meme of a genocidal robot revolution against the creators." Keeping with the Czech theme, my question is about my favourite Czech writer. One of the themes that Kafka is known for is the inadequacy of human reason. The systems and events that Kafka's protagonists confront seem to have an internal consistency, but not one the protagonist can grasp. Video games, on the other hand, are by definition logical systems, even if they incorporate a degree of randomness. A player can always go back to sections and see what happens if they make a different decision. Would it be possible, then, for a video game to explore this Kafka-esque theme? Or would any Kafka-based video game be doomed to a degree of ludonarrative dissonance, drink, as the themes of impenetrability conflicted with the inherent nobleness of any virtual world? Banning replay, as I've seen in some Flash games, might be one solution, but introduces new problems. Yours, Seth in Austin.
I have two examples of this. I think, actually, one of them, though, is sabotaged by the fact that you can replay it. But I would say the Stanley Parable is an earnest attempt at a Kafkaesque fiction within a game, because it is a system which you can't really interpret. And you are is a very bureaucratic system, one that in which you are kind of helplessly trapped. But a game which is genuinely Kafkaesque, in a way which is possibly not intended by the designers, is the AI Showcase Facade, in which you have really bad conversations with two bickering spouses in their swanky London apartment or wherever it is, while they make terrible drinks for you and eat finger food. The idea was that it was meant to be like a kind of natural language AI thing, where you'd enter this apartment, these married couple would be having like a bit of a breakup, and the things that you said could affect that relationship in quite complex ways. But the problem is it was just woefully under-equipped for anything that the player might say. And so you end up kind of just grappling with this kind of, obviously, a coherent and consistent AI system, but one which produces results which are completely fucking bizarre, which is kind of Kafkaesque, really. I'd just like to say, I think his definition of Kafkaesque is very good, considering that most definitions of Kafkaesque nowadays are that the buses aren't running on time. Whoa, what a Kafkaesque nightmare.
I've never heard that at a bus stop.
I think there's a level of futility to Kafkaesque scenario that games would never even try to simulate, because that's not desirable. And games are still like minded this thing where they're supposed to be entertainment products, so they can't confront you with a system that appears to be able to serve you in some way if you get it, if you interact with it correctly, but actually never will, because you're a kind of moat in a horrible giant grinding machine that doesn't care about you.
Stanley Parable does have a branch in which they ask you to repeatedly jump off a high height that's not quite high enough to kill you, so it just slightly injures you, and you have to keep it doing it again and again and again until it eventually kills you.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, yeah, no, yeah. Flower, Sun, Rain as well, which I think I mentioned in the podcast before. Which is a horrible, but intentionally horrible game by Suda51, is also sort of Kafkaesque in that the player is very transparently trapped in a really shitty DS game. And the game knows that and makes fun of the fact that you are. So yeah, that's kind of good.
Adrian F. Gibbs writes, "Hello, I'm just getting into Heroes of the Storm beta. Can you recommend essential heroes to buy with my hard-earned coins?"
The master is here with his...
The master. Notebook. Not sure I'm even over 100 hours yet, but I have written down some names of characters that you can buy that are super cheap and also pretty good. The thing about Heroes of the Storm is that the characters obviously aren't unlocked en masse from the beginning like they are in Dota, so you need to earn them, and you can either buy them with real money or you can buy them via the in-game currency. And you earn in-game currency better or quicker by fulfilling the quests, the daily quests, which will variously task you with playing as a specific a character from a specific world, so either Diablo, Starcraft or Warcraft, or a character which has a specific role, i.e. warrior, assassin, support or specialist. So, the kinds of characters that you should buy to begin with are characters which span as many of those things as possible, because then you'll earn gold quicker by being able to fulfil quests on subsequent days. So, as a warrior, I'd suggest, like, these are all the cheap heroes. You've got a kind of a choice of Sonya, ETC or Mirrodin. I'd go for ETC personally. I think he's very exciting. This kind of like... lots of mobility that you can do, and he gets to trap heroes. And
he has an electric guitar. Right?
And he is a cow who plays death metal, which is, you
got to back that.
What the fuck is this? What is that from?
Apparently it's from Warcraft. I don't know. I'm not really a Blizzard fan, so the lore of this stuff kind of just goes over my head. I really love HOTS, though. It's so stupid. As an assassin, the choice is pretty much definitely Valor, I would say, who's a Diablo character. She's the demon hunter from Diablo. And she's still just one of the most exciting heroes to play in Heroes of the Storm, even though she's a really cheap character. Loads of kind of mobility escapes, very squishy, but does just ridiculous amounts of damage. For support, I'd probably go Lily, because even though she's slightly kind of boring to play, in that she isn't, you kind of just have to press the three same buttons over and over again forever. Positioning is important with her, and also, you can rarely feel useless to your team. Like, if you're a new player, I'd definitely suggest playing Lee, because you're always going to be great. People are going to love you, regardless of, because you can't really fuck it up that badly, unless you decide to kind of run to the front line and get killed repeatedly. As long as you stay behind people, you can just be really useful to people. And support characters, specialist characters, there aren't that many that are at a really low tier, but Gazlo's probably too hard for most people, I would say. He's pretty cheap. I go for Tassadar, who's also a StarCraft character, of which there are very few in the game. So when you get a StarCraft quest to play as a StarCraft character, you're pretty much boned, unless you want to pay, a lot of money for one. So Tassadar is the only real pick there. Though, out of all of those, one of the cheap characters now, he wasn't cheap when I bought him, but he is cheap now, is Anubarak, who's a giant beetle. And I really like him. He's kind of like an unshowy character at the beginning of the game, but you can kind of, if you keep him up during the course of a game, he does have all this kind of life steal stuff and spawns little tiny beetles that can do stuff, and he gets to kind of burrow under the earth and then pops out and he's like, "Surprise, motherfuckers!" And somebody's trying to escape. It's great. And also, if you want to spend £8, you can buy a skin which turns him into a ladybug that has hearts on his wings.
Have you spent £8, Marty?
I will not disclose my my payments on this game.
What is he from?
I have no fucking clue.
I thought it was going to be like...
Oh, Warcraft. He's from one of the early Warcraft games. World of Warcraft.
isn't he a Zerg dude?
I thought it would all be stuff that I recognised. Oh. But, like, I don't think I recognise any of it. Oh, Tassadar, I've heard that name, but that's about it.
There's loads of bullshit characters apparently in Blizzard fiction. It is mostly nonsense. But the best thing about it is you can just buy... Blizzard seem very kind of serious about their fiction, but you can turn Diablo into a giant frog. I don't know. All of my characters ride around on this little pony that farts out gold and rainbows.
Okay.
So there you go.
Good answer. Max Ursler writes, "Hail Criff and Crowbar. With all the recent remakes / reboots, what old game of your youth would you like to see zapped with an updatinator?"
I was going to mention Dawn of War 1, which I did go back to like 6 months ago, and it aged well visually, and the fantasy deserves a really sumptuous, large-scale version of that same game, but in a modern engine, and a remake could do that justice.
You don't think Total War Warhammer is going to scratch?
Oh, no, that will scratch my biggest nerd itch. it's the hole in my nerd life that has always been waiting to be filled in that game. But this is a 40k, so it's a slightly different nerd slant, which I'm almost equally passionate about. But fucking hell, I'm really excited about Total War Warhammer. So I'm a massive nerd for Total War, and I played Warhammer since I was like 12, so this is just absurd.
Talinki writes, "For a communist game, try the Tomorrow Children. It's about communism and the player's resources in each city are pooled."
Oh yeah, we mentioned previously, and I think it was a question asking us which games defied kind of capitalist systems, because capitalist systems are very easy to game, so I think that's probably one of the reasons why there are so many of them. But obviously there's not much reason to game like perfect socialism, is there? Which is probably why it's more of a utopian ideal.
But the Tomorrow Children apparently is a thing we should play.
Yeah.
I don't think I've even heard of
it. No. Interesting.
Oh, never heard of it.
Thank you for the recommendation. Check it out.
James C. Liz, or Ailes, probably, writes, "Asked about non-capitalist games, how about multiplayer Minecraft and Gary's Mod, where goal is to build collaboratively?"
Oh, yeah. Another answer to the same question.
Or make giant dicks.
Yes.
Or burn down
just as they
house
did in
spite.
Soviet Russia.
That's why I went to shit. That's why I had to abandon the whole thing.
Stalin's giant dick.
All resources on statues. Mm. And that's all the time for questions we have.
Mm. You can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet at us. We're at Crate and Crowbar on Twitter. And you can follow us individually. I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I am at Gonnas, GONNAS.
I'm the other Tom. I'm at PCG Ludo, LUDO.
I'm Marsh Davis, DAVIES.
Thanks for joining us, everybody!
I see, you've got to say that now for the next 5 years.
Metapolitics.